Climate Connection.
Zhu Zemamri is the Director of Impact at Regenerative Creations, an impact fund investing in companies that enable a better and more sustainable world. She is also the UK delegate to the G7 Youth Summit, where she covers climate policy. Welcome to the podcast, Zhuja.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So, Zhuja, perhaps we could begin by you explaining what your role is as the UK delegate to the G7 Youth Summit.
So I am one of four UK delegates to the G7 Youth Summit this year. The Youth Summit is one of the seven official engagement groups for the G7. So we work to put together a list of policy recommendations in a communique with other delegates from the other G7 countries and are ensuring that ministers and leaders are thinking of young people in policymaking. So we're having lots of meetings with various offices in government, as well as the ministers leading the negotiations. But a big part of my role is consulting with young people in the UK and to ensure that their voices are heard. And so asking them about their opinions on climate change, the problems and the solutions that they see are necessary. And this has been a really great year to get involved, as the UK is hosting the G7 Leaders Summit in June and also COP26 later this year. So it's been really exciting to represent the UK on this international stage.
And what have the young people been telling you so far? What are some of the main themes that have emerged in your discussions with them?
So we've just started our series of focus groups. We sent out a large survey last week, and now we're doing smaller, more intimate discussions with young people across the UK. I think what's coming out most prominently for me so far is that some of the topics that young people are talking about aren't necessarily on or covered by the UK COP26 presidency's five key campaign areas. And one of those key ones is climate migration and what climate displacement looks like. And another one is young people talking about how they see climate change affecting sort of their local area. So young people in coastal towns or young people in traditional farming households and what land management looks like. And so I think it's really bringing out the fact that as much as we can talk about the climate crisis and we see pictures of destruction happening around the world, actually a lot of changes are happening in the UK. And so it's been really great to be able to refocus on the way that the climate crisis is affecting young people in the UK specifically, and hearing more about the problems that they're increasingly facing.
And do you think those issues would be similar in other countries, that sort of emphasis on the localized nature of how people are noticing about climate change, which is taking place?
I think so. I think for a lot of us in the UK, we sit in a position where maybe we haven't been faced with some of the really drastic effects of climate change so far. Yet there are people around the world who have been, you know, dealing with the consequences of the climate crisis for decades now. And so I think it's really important to recognize that even if we can't see it, that it's happening, but also to recognize how it is happening within our own communities and with our own country. And so looking at the more marginalized communities within the UK, as well as the global south, where a lot of the climate, you know, devastation is happening, but looking at marginalized communities in the UK and how they're already being affected by some aspects of climate change or the climate crisis. So just talking about how some communities, particularly communities of color, are living in areas where there's higher rates of air pollution and the medical and health consequences of that, and just how far reaching it is. And it doesn't just exist in sort of, okay, there's this one catastrophic weather event and that's when we see climate change, but rather in these everyday impacts that are happening.
And like you say, with something like air pollution, which isn't necessarily directly visible, but obviously has a huge and significant impact, not only on people's lives, but for example, on children's learning.
Exactly, definitely. And the way in which I think there was a recent study that showed that your race is more indicative of whether you will be affected by air pollution than poverty. And so really bringing in these other, you know, aspects of the climate crisis into the conversation. I think for so long it's been siloed as an environmental issue, but really looking at it as wider than that. And it's a social justice issue as well as an economic justice issue as well.
So you see climate justice as being very much linked to other forms of social justice, that we shouldn't divide those issues anymore. We should be seeing that they are embedded within each other.
Yeah, I think trying to separate them just sort of leads to failure, because you're not tackling the whole problem. And the idea that environmental, economic and social justice exist on different planes is just false. I mean, as I said, there's a proven link between racial inequity and the effects of climate change. So it's really making sure that if we're going to be coming up with solutions and policies specifically around climate, that we make sure that they're as inclusive as possible.
And with some of the groups that you talk to, Zhuzhe, do you get the sense that young people are optimistic or pessimistic about their futures with regards to the climate? Do they feel empowered to do things, or is the feeling more of resignation?
I feel like it's too soon to comment on that, because we were still at the very beginning stages of our consultation period. But that's something that I'm really eager to find out more about, because I think that's what lends a lot of value to areas of engagement like sort of the Y7 and the COP26 Youth Summit, is allowing young people giving them the platform to have a voice in these conversations. Because I do think a lot of young people, and this is just speculation at this point, feel like government leaders and business leaders, it's not just within sort of the policy arena, aren't doing enough. And as cliche as it sounds, we as young people we're tomorrow's leaders, essentially, and we're going to inherit tomorrow's problems. And no, sorry, we're going to inherit today's problems tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so I think without us having a say in some of the policy that is being drafted or some of the decisions that are being made today, we're going to have to deal with the consequences of either those policies not being inclusive enough, not being far-reaching enough, not being radical enough. And so I think it's really important that young people do have more of a say, I think, around any policy area, to be honest, but specifically climate.
And what role do you think teachers in the classroom have to play in bringing some of these issues to young people, allowing a space for the discussion of these issues within the classroom?
So, I mean, just based off of my own experience, I was educated in the UK. I don't believe I had a strong enough climate education growing up, and very much my information around the climate crisis did not come from within the classroom. And so I think there's just more that can be done on a very simple level of increasing climate education. I think there was a survey recently that said just 4% of young people surveyed felt that they know a lot about climate change. And so we really need to be changing that statistic. And so I think teachers are in a really powerful position to do that. And I think we need to do it from a very interdisciplinary angle. So, you know, my experience was, if we learned anything about the environment, it was very much in sort of the science classroom or in geography, but geography isn't even a compulsory subject after a certain age. So it's making sure that we're talking about climate, and teachers are talking about climate in all manners of subjects, and it's not isolated to sort of science or STEM. Because I think that can be really off-putting then for students who don't necessarily feel like they excel in those areas naturally, to then sort of not be able to learn about the climate from different subject areas. So I think there's a lot that can be done to make sure that there's a more holistic approach to climate education.
And I guess as well, in the current system, it feels like the climate, if it's a standalone issue, that somehow you can choose whether to be interested in it or not. But if it's something which is more embedded throughout the curriculum, then it's going to reach all students, and then they can move forward with that however they wish.
Exactly. Yeah, it needs to be accessible. And I think the way that it can be the most accessible is that it is, as you said, embedded across the curriculum. And I think that there's an element of standardization within the national curriculum. So I don't believe that climate education is currently part of the UK national curriculum. Might be wrong on that one. because then you're also ensuring that there's the same standard of teaching and education across the country. You don't want it to be that if you go to a certain school, you have more insights into what's happening in the world in regards to climate change than if you went to another school. So it's really, and I think a big part of that is also teacher training and making sure that teachers feel empowered to teach about climate change, because that's another big issue. If teachers don't feel empowered to speak on a topic, then that's going to trickle down and affect the way that young people sort of receive that learning.
And again, if we can normalise that in teachers' initial teacher training and then in the institutional expectations of what they should be doing in the classroom, then they'll also be more confident to do that.
Yeah, and I think just making it, demystifying it and making it not a scary subject to talk about. I mean, there's a lot of discussions around eco-anxiety in young people, and I think it's also training teachers and how to hold those conversations and hold space for those conversations around the climate crisis in a way that keeps young people engaged and feeling empowered. I guess it goes back to your question around whether people, you know, young people feel pessimistic or optimistic for the future. Climate education isn't just important because it helps young people understand how they can sort of adapt their own lives in response to the climate crisis, but it's also because young people are going to be the people who are going to be coming up with the solutions, hopefully, to solve some aspects of this crisis. And so I think it needs to be really empowering, and young people need to feel like they can be part of the solution. And that really starts in the classroom.
So in a sense, it's can be a little bit changing the narrative, because, again, it seems to me often when we talk about climate change or when it's in the news, it's always negative. It feels oppressive, and it can lead to, like you say, this eco-anxiety. But if we can flip the narrative around a little bit and talk more positively about it, then that may impact again on young people and what they feel they are able to do.
Yes, exactly. And I definitely don't have the answer to this, because I think there's a fine line between, you know, really imprinting on young people the severity of this crisis. That's important. That needs to happen. It can't be seen as something that will happen, you know, in 50 years' time and it's down the road and it's not going to affect young people in their lifetimes. But as you said, also making sure that it's done in a way in which young people don't then get scared and sort of run away from it and bury their heads in the sand, but rather feel like, okay, this is something that I can be a part of helping to solve. And maybe a big part of that is really bringing out this narrative of being a collective. Like, we're sort of all in this together, even though some communities will be affected more by climate change than others. Like, let's sort of bring ourselves together and collaborate, and collaboration really being key here to help create some of the solutions.
Perhaps one way of doing that as well with younger people is to focus on things like the green economy and green jobs. Perhaps I could ask you a little bit about if you see there's a link between climate literacy and financial literacy.
Yeah, so I think traditionally they've both been sort of subject areas that young people have had sort of a lack of access to in terms of education, or at least traditional education. Yet they're both subject areas that will massively affect the way young people live their lives. You know, post-COVID, we will be in a probably prolonged economic crisis, just like we are currently in a climate crisis. So I think there's an element of similarity between the two, in the sense that they're both under-talked about, yet have massive effects on young people's livelihoods. But at the same time, I also think they influence each other. And so if we can educate young people on how they can use their money for good, then that is so powerful. Being able to understand that your money is your vote, and also that you don't have to be particularly wealthy or be an investor or have a ton of savings in order to be able to use your money in this way. So there's a great campaign called Make My Money Matter, which is about demanding that your pension is invested in a better future. I'm working with The Big Issue that have just launched their new climate solutions fund that can be accessed through a junior ISA. So that's another way that young people can be using, you know, their spare change or any savings they do have to be investing in companies that are positively contributing to solving the climate crisis. And I think there's a lot of... Sorry, Julia, carry on. I was just going to say, I think there's a lot of conversation around the sort of differences in validity, I guess, between individual actions. So things that we can change in our own lives. So not using plastic straws being an example of that. And then the types of changes that need to happen on a much larger and generally corporate level that will really make that shift happen. And I think this is a great way to sort of, I'm trying to think of the right word. This is a great way to do both at the same time. So it's, you know, using your individual power as a consumer to be able to influence big changes on a corporate level, because in reality, a lot of young people don't have influence or power in corporate decision making or in the business world. But actually, if we recognize the power that we have collectively as consumers and leverage that so that we are making sure that we're saying, actually, no, I don't want to invest in a company that is still using fossil fuels, or I don't want my pension to be sitting in an investment fund that invests in companies that still use fossil fuels. I think that's a really powerful way for young people to be able to be making a difference, even with a very small amount of money.
And I guess as well, just those individual actions, but for a collective good, can also be a way of reducing people's eco-anxiety, because if they feel they have agency, they feel they are doing something, however small that may be. But if they then see their friends and other young people doing something similar, that can be a way of them developing resilience to the climate crisis and feeling they can act on it in a more positive way.
Exactly. And I think, and just building that conversation around it as well. And I think that's an important part of, you know, what happens inside versus outside the classroom, that climate education shouldn't just sort of stop with, you know, inside the four walls of a classroom or at the end of an exam, but rather should be the spark that ignites a series of much bigger conversations between young people and their peers, their families, their colleagues, whoever it is, to be able to allow them to advocate for certain changes that are more in line with their own understanding of how they want to be contributing to the solutions around the climate crisis.
And I guess as well, so going back to your work as the UK delegate to the G7 Youth Summit, this will be presumably the sort of things that you're discussing with your colleagues there about creating those international network so that these sorts of ideas can be shared more freely.
Exactly. And I think there has been an increase in different engagement opportunities, and especially around COP26 this year. There's a pre-COP and COP26 youth summit that young people can get involved in. But it has to be long lasting. And it can't just be focused around these specific events. I think there has to be continual engagement. And it's not just engagement where sort of, oh, we've consulted the youth, this is what they say, but it doesn't actually get translated into policy. It needs to be concrete in a way that the voice of young people is embedded in the policy decision-making sort of bubble around climate. As I said, around any policy area, theoretically, but specifically around climate. I think Wales is the first, am I getting this right? Sorry, one second.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Wales has a Future Generations Commissioner. And I think that's a really important way of making sure that in any policy decision, the future generation is being considered. And unfortunately, I think with climate, that's what's gone wrong in decades past, is a lot of climate decisions have been made without really considering the impact on future generations. So even something as simple, although probably bureaucratically complex, as having a future generations commissioner who can be part of the policy decision making. Because I was at an event the other day where they were talking about how, you know, it's not enough to just have these youth engagement groups that sort of turn up once a year, say their piece and are listened to, but not really involved in the whole process. Like, we also need to encourage young people to get more involved in policy making and more involved in all the different aspects of the way that the government, but also the business world, can be changing to be in a more environmentally conscious direction. And I think that's the beauty of the Y7 is it really, it isn't just, okay, we have the Y7 summit in May and that's it, but actually it's a year-long process for any delegate who's involved. And from when you're selected as a delegate, you start talking with young people across the UK, and then you're presenting your findings to, you know, heads of state and world leaders. And then you're also continuing after the Y7 summit and then the G7 leaders summit to make sure that you're implementing some of the policy recommendations as much as you can on a local level and having that impact past the summit itself.
And then will you be reporting back to the young people that you've been talking to? So what happens with your relationship with them going forward?
Yeah, so we will be making sure that we will have a final impact report that will go out sort of at the end of our tenure as a delegate. But also the communique that we put together will be accessible for all young people. And the summit itself, young people can attend and access. And so it's a really great opportunity for them to see what it's like to be either a Y7 delegate or just if they're interested in watching some of the conversations that we'll be having.
And if I could ask you more sort of generally, Zhuzhe, as I say, we're on this podcast, we're also interested in the relationship of language and the English language with the climate crisis. From your experience in your work as UK delegate to the G7 Youth Summit, and also more widely in your professional life, how do you see the role of language impacting the climate crisis?
Yeah, I think there's a big piece of education that can be done around the language we use in terms of the climate crisis. Like a lot of different things, climate and the environment can often be laden with acronyms and complex terminology, and that can be very inaccessible to a lot of young people, but to especially young people from maybe more marginalized communities. And so I think we need to think really carefully about how we talk about what's happening. And actually the Guardian changed, I believe it was in 2019, changed their rules on language around climate. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, they weren't using climate change anymore, but rather the climate crisis. But then even if we take that a step further, I was reading the other day about how a lot of people are adopting the phrase climate emergency. But there are problems that come out of using the term emergency and what that means in already quite militarized contexts, and how emergency or climate emergency can be used in certain countries as a way to prolong states of emergency, etc. So I think really thinking intentionally about the language we use is so important. But then on a more global level, and talking about the different languages that exist in the world, the climate crisis is not constrained to any one border. And I think in itself, it demonstrates the importance of sort of foreign language learning, and that we really need to collaborate if we're going to make any positive steps to solve the crisis. And that's one of the beauties of being part of the Y7, is that we get to work with delegates from the other G7 countries in order to form these common policy recommendations. And these
Yeah, if it's okay, I'm just going to ask you a little bit about that, because I think that was a really, really interesting point about the word emergency. So yeah, so the climate emergency, which was the Oxford English Dictionary's sort of phrase of the year in 2019, but you're saying that can be interpreted in different ways around the world, and that's perhaps one of the challenges, where English is the dominant global language, that may be a phrase that people hear in different countries and interpret very differently.
Exactly. And I think it just goes back to the point around making sure that we're taking a climate justice approach to understanding the climate crisis. So really thinking about it's sort of outside our bubble of either the UK or the global north, but thinking about how people in different parts of the world are being affected. And as you said, I think language being a really important way, or an important lens through which we can consider that, and the fact that language means different things depending on where you are in the world. And also to say that it's not just about sort of the words that we're using or the terminology that we're using in English when we're talking about the climate crisis, but it's also the languages that we are using to talk about it in. So for example, the Y7 is predominantly in English,
And a lot of these conversations happen predominantly in English or other major world languages. And because climate change is not constrained to any one border, and it really needs the involvement of people all around the world in order to come up with solutions to the climate crisis, it means that we need to be having discussions in a wide variety of languages.
And again, this is linking back to the point you were making about linking climate justice to social justice, that if we're not using non-dominant languages, if we're excluding minority languages from the conversation, then those people don't necessarily have a voice, or they don't have the strongest possible voice in climate discussions.
And there's a large group of people who are often left out of the climate conversation. And these are people who are from marginalized communities in the UK, but also in the global south. That there's so much that we can be learning from indigenous communities around the world, for example, who, despite contributing the least to climate change, are facing some of the worst effects. And these are also groups that have been facing language erasure for decades. And climate change is only going to exacerbate this, as, you know, increases the number of climate refugees and internal displacement and splinters communities and leads to the loss of languages in that way. So I think there's a really important link between preserving sort of language and cultural diversity at the same time as we try and preserve biodiversity. I think those are inherently linked.
And I guess we could see as well, you talked at the beginning of sort of the increase in climate migration and climate refugees and so on. I guess there's also a risk that as that increases, language is often at the sort of forefront of refugee discourses, and it can be the most obvious divider between one group and another group. And you could potentially see language becoming a sort of another fault line in that debate.
Yes, and even so, actually, my academic background is in migration research, so I always love talking about the impacts of climate on migration. But going back to the other sense of the word language, and talking about the terminology we are using, even the fact that as we talk about climate refugees, they're not actually recognised as part of the UN Convention on Refugees, because climate is not considered one of the reasons in which people would sort of flee a country, or one of the valid reasons in which people would flee a country under that definition. So it's also making sure, you know, policy influences language and language influences policy, and making sure that they reflect each other. And as we have an increased amount of climate refugees, making sure that they are recognized legally as refugees and afforded the protection that other refugees would have, because I think that's going to be one of the things that we're going to run into in the next, you know, however many decades, is that actually a lot of people who are fleeing because of the effects of the climate crisis aren't entitled to the same protection or support because they're not legally considered refugees. So even though we use this language of climate refugee, what does that actually mean in practice and in the protections that people are afforded?
Yeah, and it's difficult to say at the moment, I guess, that it's a contested term, because it's a term that doesn't have any legal status.
Exactly. And so I think it's going back to the point of trying to draw that line between theory and practice, and making sure that we're not just talking about these things in some sort of abstract way, but actually making sure that they're related to policies or adjustments that are being put in place to help people. I think that's really important.
And I just wanted to go back as well a little bit, Zsuzsa. We talked before about how language has historically been used perhaps to exclude people from the climate discussion. You know, you said about use of abbreviations and complex terminology and these sorts of things. So again, you would be advocating a strong shift away from that, to sort of, again, demystifying the issues and presenting things in a more accessible way.
Yeah, I think that's really key. And I think it also is about encouraging foreign language learning. Sorry if I said this bit before, but I don't know why I got cut off. I think it's about making sure that we recognize, as I was saying, that to come up with the best solutions, we need to be collaborative. And so that's what the Y7 does really well is we work with delegates from other G7 countries in order to collaborate and put together these policy recommendations. And I think there's an increased need for young people in various contexts, but specifically in the UK, to strengthen their foreign language skills in order to be able to have some of these conversations and to be able to have some of these conversations outside of sort of the conventional routes. So like speaking to local communities in other countries and finding out ways in which in the UK or in their own community, they can be helping them. And so I think that it does just really put an emphasis on the beauty of being able to speak multiple languages is being able to collaborate and understand different people's perspectives and opinions. And that's really necessary for us going forward in trying to come up with solutions for the climate crisis.
And I guess as well, aside from the practical value that you've discussed there, there's also that sort of deeper philosophical value in learning a second language, is that it opens people's eyes up and their minds up to other cultures and enables people to empathize and to see how other people are facing the climate crisis and what they're trying to do about it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the climate crisis doesn't recognize borders, right? This is not something that recognizes the delineations between different countries and says, okay, there's going to be a climate crisis in this country and not in another country. And I think it just really needs to push us to also think beyond sort of this bordered world that we live in and think more about who we are as part of a global collective and understanding, and within that global collective, not erasing certain people's experiences and really actually uplifting the experiences of those who are suffering the most at the hands of the climate crisis and those communities that have been the most traditionally marginalized. And I think that's really, you know, the essence of when we talk about climate justice or even a just transition. It's about making sure that we're not just moving towards hopefully a greener world, but also a fairer world.
And one final question, Zsuzsa, could I ask you what you think the role of multilateral institutions and organisations such as the British Council, what should they be doing to help fight the climate crisis?
So I think, you know, there's that big piece around education. And if I spoke about the need to have some sort of standardised education or climate curriculum in the UK to make sure that everyone is receiving the same quality of education. But I think that can also be standardized on a global level to a certain extent, making sure that everyone around the world is receiving education around the climate crisis. Obviously, it will look slightly different and will be contextualized in the local community context, but making sure that everyone has access to great quality climate education. I think there's an important role that institutions that work in multiple different countries and especially countries in the global south can play in recentering the voices of the local communities and making sure that in this conversation, those who are being disproportionately affected by climate change have the ability to talk about it and to talk about what solutions they believe need to be put on the table and what changes they need to have made.
And for those solutions to be listened to seriously and not just given lip service to.
Exactly. And I think that's historically been some of the contention around youth engagement in any policy area, but climate change specifically is, you know, where does the lip service end and the action start? And so it's really making sure that as big institutions move forward with different youth engagement activities, really figuring out how that youth voice is actually centered in the conversation rather than just an add-on at the end to be like, oh, and we spoke to young people and they agreed, or this is what they said.
Zsuzsa, thank you very much indeed for your time today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
The Climate Connection.